Big show on Tuesday, August the 6th. We welcomed Vicky Tesoro, the first selectman of Trumbull, to the program to talk about what's going on in her town. We also chatted with Wayne Pesch. He's the president of the Connecticut Food Association, about the recent bag tax legislation passed in Connecticut regarding plastic bags and what his members face on a daily basis, including an upcoming spike in the minimum wage here in the state. And also, I had a few thoughts regarding the spineless and gutless New York Times. And how are you? Hour number two up and underway on this Tuesday, and it's 3:07. We welcome in another one of our local leaders. We like to have our local education and municipal leaders on from our area towns just to check in and see what's going on. It's good to talk to somebody when all heck isn't hitting the fan. So let's find out what's going on in the town of Trumbull, a bit to our north here in Bridgeport. And we welcome the first selectman of the town of Trumbull, Vicky Tesoro. Vicky, Paul here at WICC. How are you?
Good, Paul. How are you?
I'm all right. Enjoying the summer? Is Trumbull basking in the summer warmth? What's going on?
Yes. Well, finally, I think we are. It took a long time to get here, but
yeah.
it is enjoyable to feel the heat of that sun.
Yeah, and you know, the towns like Trumbull and municipalities all over the state, it is kind of fun, Vicky, when, you know, the summer festivals come and maybe the outdoor music and the kids and everybody can get together for those typical American kind of things that all the towns do.
Well, that, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. And certainly when you think of Trumbull, most people do. You get the image of a small New England town, the charm and the character. And we have all of those wonderful things here in Trumbull during the summer, for sure. We just had our annual Trumbull Day celebration at the end of June, which was a big success this year. And, you know, we certainly have all those other options for our community. We have summer concerts. We have our pools are opened. Our parks are open. So certainly we have all of those wonderful summer opportunities here in Trumbull.
You served, obviously, in government in Trumbull for years. You're very active, and then you became first selectman. What made you want to do that?
That's a great question, one that I'm asked very often.
Out of wonderment or out of, why would you do this?
Well, maybe a little of both.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess it was more of just a natural succession into this part of the government. I was very active for years in the schools,
yep.
Very much of an education advocate. And when my youngest child left for college, I became active in the political realm. So I ran for the Board of Education back in 2009. I didn't win at that point, but I didn't give up. I ran in 2011 for the town council in District 3, and I won, and I served a couple terms on the council. And then in 2015, I took the big leap and ran for first selectman. And again, you know, I didn't win that election, but it's like you never give up trying. And I was appointed to the Board of Finance for a year and a half, and then decided to run one more time in 2017 for first selectman. And here I am.
When somebody came to you on election night, Vicky, and said, you know what, you got it, we won it, you're in, what was your first thought? Remember what that was like?
I do. I was extremely excited, obviously, and then said, "Oh my God!" Just basically what you said before. Here we go. So it was a bit overwhelming, but certainly I felt I was prepared for the task. And 20 months later or so, I've been doing the job, and I think I've had lots of successes in those 20 months. And it's been challenging at times, of course, but it's been rewarding at the same time.
Is it as hard as you thought? Not as hard, or tougher? How would you categorize that?
Probably a little bit of everything. You know, it's certainly a learning curve when you walk into this office for the first time. I was on the other side of government as a volunteer, really, when I served on the council and the Board of Finance. And this is a whole new ballgame when you sit in the in this office and you are basically in charge of running the town. And there's lots to learn when you walk in here. I certainly would be the first one to admit that, I didn't even know where the bathroom was. So it was a large learning curve, but certainly the people here at Town Hall that I've worked with over the last year and a half or so have been wonderful. These are career people that are doing their job, and they have nothing but here to help me and help this town run smoothly for the residents.
Vicki Tesoro, the guest here on Connecticut Today at 10 past 3, the first selectman of the town of Trumbull. You know, Vicki, you come in, as you say, you have a lot of career people. I've been familiar with town governments all over the state, and you have the career people. You have the union people, the longstanding unions in any city or town. And then you, like any elected official from the president on down, you want to bring in your own people, people you know, people you trust to work with on the tough day-to-day things. So it must be a little difficult getting the right balance, or not. You tell me.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I certainly brought in a few people, just what you said, who, you know, that I knew for a long time and worked with before in various capacities. But to be honest with you, excuse me, when you come into a position like this and it's your first term, you know, it would be silly to say I'm going to, you know, make sure that I replace every person that works here with somebody that I know and interview and whatever. It takes a long time to do something mm-hmm. like that. You don't have time to do things like that. You really have to, you know, you have to start and go and make sure that our, you know, vital municipal services are taken care of, that our schools are well run. So you don't really, at least I didn't feel comfortable just saying I'm going to replace everybody that's in town hall with someone else to do that, because you can't interrupt government. It has to keep flowing.
I've heard from leaders at all levels, from Congress on down to offices like yours, Vicki, that an effective leader needs at least one person who can close the door. You can close the door, sit down with this person, and that person can look you in the eye, say, you know what? No, this is a bad idea. Don't do that. I'm not going to ask you to name names. Do you have one of those people?
Sure, I do.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, that's key. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you're right. You know, you need to be able to bounce ideas off someone or some people and get some feedback and know that you're, you know, headed in the right direction and you're doing what's best for the community. And sometimes you have thoughts about what that is and others think it's something different. So it is best to bounce those ideas, you know, around the table. But in the end, the buck stops here. I am the leader of the town, and I take responsibility for whatever decisions that are made from this office.
I have always thought, looking at any sort of politics, especially when you get to the, you know, out of the cities, out of Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, I've always thought, and people have agreed and disagreed with me to a point, that I've said, look, people basically want three things. They want the cops and the firemen to come. They want their municipal services. They want their streets plowed, the leaves picked up, and they want a reasonable tax rate. Would you say that that's the three biggest things you look at in the town?
Yes, without a doubt. I mean, the number one thing that's always on people's minds, residents' minds, are their taxes. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to make sure the taxes are as low as possible, but they're still getting their services that they want. So that's always been it is my focus and will continue to be my focus, is to keep our taxes as low as we possibly can keep them, but also maintain our vital municipal services. You know, to keep public safety is always number one on the list, and to keep our schools well funded, and our EMS and our other services for our residents. But that certainly is paramount. And I will tell you, and I say to people that what does politics have to do with all of that? You know, really,
no, you're
nothing.
Right. No, you're right.
Everybody in the community wants to make sure that they have good schools, that their roads are paved and they're plowed, and they have police protection and EMS services, and they have their pools are open in the summer and their parks are clean. That has nothing to do with politics. Everyone in the community should want the same thing.
Vicki Tesoro joins us again, the first selectman of the town of Trumbull. So, Vicki, if somebody comes to you from out of state, out of the country, and they say, hey, great to meet you, and they sit down in their office and they look at you and they say, so, Madam First Electman, how is your town doing? How is Trumbull doing? What would you tell them?
Well, I have to be as the representative of this community, the number one representative. I'd say Trumbull's doing great. Mm-hmm. We have a great school system in Trumbull. It's certainly one of the magnets of this community that draws people here, and that's something that we continue to always to focus on and make sure that we're funding it properly, because not only do we want to provide a number one school system for our students and families, but we want to make sure that also, retains the property values in this community, because obviously as people move in and out, they want to make sure that they're making a sound investment in their real estate. And this is a largely residential community. We have over 12,000 single-family homes in Trumbull.
Wow.
Yes, a lot of homes, so we want to make sure that we keep the value of those homes for our residents. Again, the quality of life, excellent education system. We have extensive parks. I don't know if anyone knows, but we have over 1,600 acres of townland as recreational areas and open space in Trumbull. And that's more recreational, or the most recreational and open space per capita in the state.
Wow.
So we have lots to offer in this wonderful community to families and residents, all residents, single families, singles, to families, to senior citizens. It's just a great community to move into and to grow and to stay here. As you continue mm-hmm. on with your life in Trumbull.
And the thing though that it's always a balancing act, right? And I've heard from mayors all over, including the mayor in my town. It's nice when the smaller areas or the out of the way towns, the suburbs, get discovered, but eventually a whole lot of people are going to move there over the course of 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and you look at a population number now versus, say, a generation ago, and you say, okay, it's nice that a lot of people are living here, but it's a little more complicated to run now.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very true. I mean, Trumbull is 98% developed, so there isn't much room for much more development here. Mm-hmm. But of course, we need to remain competitive with other communities and provide a diverse housing stock here, so that we continue to draw people into this community and also allow our seniors a place to retire here if they so choose. And we'd love them to stay here, whether it's in their own home or another type of housing. So we too have to recognize that we have to be able to diversify our housing stock in order to do that. So nothing stays the same, and it's hard for people to change, but things do change, and we want to be involved in that, because we compete with other communities around us for people to move in here.
And, even though, Vicki, you said you're about 98% developed, do you still have developers who come in on the retail side and even on the residential side who have these plans that they want to put before you and the councilors there and the town legislators to try and squeeze a little more in there? Is that always a tough call?
Well, it is. It is a balance, and we've had that happen over the last couple of years here, or 2 or 3 years, where we've had developers. And I mean, I think that's a good thing that there are developers who want to spend millions of dollars to develop in our community. But mm-hmm. on the other hand, we do have to balance that with the residential character and quality of our community. And I've been doing just that as first selectman, making sure that we make sure that balance stays where it remains, because that's what draws people and makes people want to stay in Trumbull, is the quality and character of this community.
And
so it's a delicate balance.
Yeah, and again, if you don't want it to get to a point, correct, where you get so jammed up, then all of a sudden, demand outstrips supply, and there go the housing prices. It's great that somebody can, make $100,000 or $200,000 on that house they bought 20 years ago, but it also, as you say, restricts who can move back into the town.
Right. I think that's very true. And, we see that here. We see, our housing market generally has, within the houses that are, around the $400,000 to $500,000 are selling well. But we have a low inventory right now in Trumbull. It may be similar to other communities. We do want to make sure, just as you said, that there is a market for people to be able to sell their homes once they make that investment here.
Heading into the fall now, you've got another year of school starting up soon. You've got mm-hmm. winter coming up. You've got all the things you have to look at there. What are some of the immediate challenges? Maybe a couple of things that you and the folks in the town who run the town are going to be focusing on, say, in the next year or so.
Well, as you know, certainly, as I said a few minutes ago, our schools are award-winning schools, and they are a magnet to people coming in here, wanting to move into Trumbull. So we want to make sure that we, you know, maintain that our quality of our education system, and that it remains competitive with other schools. And of course, I mean, what the biggest challenge of this last year was with the state funding of our our schools, which, you know, Trumbull ended up faring a little bit better than we thought we were going to, but there was a lot of advocacy going on with the state to make sure that we remained in the place where we were getting our share of our ECS, or the education cost sharing dollars. So we came out about $200,000 less than we did the year before. And again, as I said, during last year's budget season, I really advocated with our state officials to make sure that Trumbull got the dollars that we should have gotten, and that we weren't having to pick up that teacher retirement expense. Yeah. You know, with both of those, that would have been a $1.2 million hit to the town of Trumbull. So we came out much better, and we were able to continue to fund the schools in a competitive manner. You know, over the last 2 years, I've increased funding to the schools by over $5 million, while at the same time making sure that we were funding our public service, our other vital municipal services, and making sure we're taking care of our seniors. So again, it's all a balancing act that you have to do to make sure that you keep your taxes as low as possible, but you know, you keep your spending in check. And again, you know, looking at the, you're talking about, you know, growing our economy and growing the grand list, because there's, you know, there's just a couple ways that you really can maintain a low tax rate, and then one of them is keeping your spending in check, which I have done, and also is to grow your grand list in a responsible manner.
Vicki Tesoro, the first selectman of the town of Trumbull. Vicki, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. And anytime you want to come on, you've got our number. Feel free. Just call my producer, Aaron, and we'll get you on.
Thanks, Paul. It was great. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Thanks, Vicki Tesoro there, first selectman of Trumbull. All right. Not easy, folks. People do it. And what do you hear all from every one of the municipal leaders we have on? What do you hear, right? Funding the schools, making sure the schools have enough money. Think about that. Every year, it's not easy. It ain't easy. We talk about it. And we continue here on WICC 600 online at WICC600.com. It's Connecticut Today. We go from Vicki Tesoro, the first selectman of Trumbull, over to a gentleman who's a bit been in the news the last few days or last couple of weeks because of what the General Assembly has done. We welcome to the show Wayne Pesch. He is president of the CFA, the Connecticut Food Association. They've been in the news regarding the bag bill, bag taxes, and all that. Wayne, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
Hi, good afternoon, Paul. How are you?
I'm good. Wayne, let's get right to it. First of all, before we get to the situation with the whole plastic bag tax and retailers and how they're dealing with that and, you know, other things that your organization deals with, what is the Connecticut Food Association?
So the Connecticut Food Association represents almost all of the grocery retailers in the state of Connecticut up at the state capitol, working on issues like the bag law, the bottle bill, food waste initiatives, wine and grocery stores. So we're an advocate on behalf of grocery suppliers here in the state.
Now, when you say grocery stores and retailers, Wayne, does that include even the big boys, the major chains, or does that do you limit yourself to the smaller retailers, the mom and pops?
No, it's mostly grocery retailers. So it's not the big box, big club stores, but it is the larger grocery chains, down to family-owned independents and single-store operators.
Well, I got to tell you, having grown up in a family that ran a family-owned little single Italian store in New Haven on a street corner that didn't have millions of dollars to spend, I know that your efforts in that place, in that position, Wayne, are probably well-received and appreciated.
I shopped at Pegnatiero's back in the 80s.
Oh, so you know the area, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So you're a New Haven guy. You know New Haven and the area well.
I'm a Waterbury guy, but I went to Southern Connecticut and lived in New Haven for 5 years.
There you go. Just like my producer, Aaron, a proud Southern Connecticut State graduate. So what drew you to that position? I know you had been working with Coca-Cola for a bunch of years. What made you segue from that to the CFA now?
I had been doing a lot of public affairs work in, at my job at Coca-Cola. I was working in New York and Connecticut on these food associations, working as a board member. Had gone 28 years at Coca-Cola and decided it was time for a change when this job opened up. I came over here about 4 years ago, and I was very familiar with the organization, having been serving on it as a board member, and it was a natural transition for me, really.
You started out here, according to what I see in your bio, you started out driving a truck for Coke, right?
I did. Another life.
Well,
another
life. I have a friend of mine who I think he did that for like his entire career and actually retired after that. And the one thing he told me, Wayne, and before we get into the specifics here of what's going on now, the one thing he said, listen, it's like being a mailman, right? It didn't matter what weather it was. It didn't matter the neighborhood or what was going on. You had to get that soda delivered there, right?
Oh, it's interesting. I mean, you know, we used to be the guys when I started who bought the scoreboards, right?
And yeah.
The local communities. And then, you know, we turned into a logistics company. And, you know, you turn into, it's a big, big business with supply chains and, mm-hmm. and things of that nature. So, yeah, I saw a change over my 28 years, that's for sure.
Wayne Pesch joins us. He is the president of the Connecticut Food Association. Now, Wayne, I noticed your name was in the news last couple of months regarding the whole thing now with single-use plastic bags. And everybody thinks, Wayne, that, you know, this thing only affects, you know, stores like Big Y and Walbombs and ShopRite and Stop and Shop. But this goes all the way down to some of the small retailers that you represent, correct?
Yeah, so we've been working on this issue for about 6 years. And really, for us in the state of Connecticut, for example, we have 22 communities that are have either passed the law or in the process of passing a law. So from a retailer standpoint, the most important thing that we wanted to accomplish through a state law was consistency.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, business operators had one set of rules to play by. So that was very important as far as trying to work on the legislation so that we got legislation that was preemptive, that was statewide, and kind of slowed down this town-by-town, house-by-house strategy that was working out. We thought that if we could get all 169 towns in the state, it would be much easier from a consistency standpoint. So that's one of the things. The other thing was the source reduction. We figure there's about 700 million bags that are either distributed at retail, certainly produced and distributed at retail in the state of Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
This law gets to about 80% of that. So we think the source reduction will be around 500 million bags a year.
Okay.
So it's pretty significant.
I know that sometimes in the debate, though, Wayne, you were worried about, I think the language you used or the word you used was curveball that you got from the governor's office. Talk a little about that.
Well, you know, there are, first of all, this is a global, international, national, local issue, right? So in most instances, there are costs incurred by the retailers in different ways to communicate the programs. And we had submitted a bill, which is a little bit different than the bill that came out, the final bill that came out, where, mm-hmm. The nickel or the dime would go back to the retailer to support programs to get more single-use, more reusable bags into consumers' hands. So we were thrown off a bit by the fact that the state, who does have a budget deficit, needed to collect some of that money to offset some of that deficit, and that money goes to the general fund. So that was something we were a bit surprised by. But that's not a deal breaker. They sunsetted that law, so that's only for 2 years.
Yeah.
That was something that didn't see coming, but it is what it is, and we'll move forward with that. We got what we set out to accomplish, which was consistency in the law throughout the state.
But you probably aren't, and again, I understand what you meant here, because I had the same understanding that you did, and all of a sudden I'm seeing, well, this money is going to go toward patching a budget deficit here. What was it, $27 million a year for a total of, you know, $54 million? And from the retailer point of view, it's kind of like, well, wait a minute, are they just doing this for environmental reasons, or is it to patch a hole in the general fund here?
Well, there were two schools of thought. I mean, you know, the bill that came out of the Environment Committee had no fee on either plastic or paper, and in the governor's budget had money in it that was for the plastic bags. So, as the session drew to an end and finance came together and the budget folks came together, the bill eventually had the dime on it that went back to the state. But the original bill that came out of the Senate Finance Committee had no fee whatsoever. But we worked with Senator Cohen and Senator Minor, Representative D'Amico, to hammer out something that we think in the end is what's best for the state of Connecticut. You know, that money sunsets. It's going to go away.
Yeah.
And eventually this will be the new normal in the state of Connecticut. You know, the idea is that people bring their own bags. And that's really where we want to get to here. I liken it to the seatbelt law.
Yeah.
You know, 10 years ago, you got in your car and you didn't wear your seatbelt, and then they put a law in, and if they found out that you weren't wearing your seatbelt, you got fined. Mm-hmm. And eventually people wear seatbelts, and it's normal. 10 years ago, people smoked in restaurants, and they don't today. I think a year from now, this will all have died down. Most people will understand the rules of the game, and they'll bring their own bag into the store, and we'll be better off for it in the long run.
A couple of more minutes we spent with Wayne Pesch, president of the Connecticut Food Association, representing mainly small independent grocers and retailers and food chains and food stores all around the state. What's the situation currently, Wayne, with the bottle bill? I know there was some thought of expanding that in the last session of the General Assembly. Where did that end up?
So the bottle bill was enacted. It was passed in 1979. It was enacted in 1980. It's a 20th century model. The only time it's been tweaked was to increase the amount of units, specifically on water. I think they just need to open up the hood on the bottle bill and take a real good look at it and ask a bunch of the stakeholders that are involved in the process to figure out ways to make it a 21st century model.
Meaning what?
First of all, I don't think the bottle bill is going anywhere, because there's an unclaimed nickel that the state gets to the tune of about $35 million a year.
Wow, it is that much. So they get $35 million worth of unclaimed nickels every year.
So when folks don't redeem those bottles or cans or plastic bottles, that's all captured, and that money is that those unclaimed nickels are remitted back to the state. It's called the sheets. And then the other money that consumers do bring back, that nickel that they do bring back to the store, goes back to the consumer. But right now we only have about 50% of bottles and cans that are taken out of retail that are actually brought back to our stores.
Okay.
The rest goes into the blue bin or the yellow bin. But those materials are cleaner materials. They're better materials. We've lost the infrastructure around the state. The only place that you can really, I think there's only 7 redemption centers and grocery stores where you can take your bottles and cans to. So that's one of the problems with the bottle bill today. We don't have enough places for people to bring their products back to. So that's one of the issues. In the state of Connecticut, the grocery retailers have the lowest handling fee, which means what we get paid to handle those bottles and cans, to clean the rooms and rent the machines, it's the lowest in the country. There are 10 states with bottle laws.
Mm-hmm.
Connecticut retailers get paid half, 1.75 cents, to collect all of those materials. So believe it or not, when you walk into a Big Y or a Stop and Shop or a ShopRite, those retailers are losing money in those bottle rooms.
Wow.
But again, that's because we've been in this for 50 years and they've never gotten a raise to do that work.
So the level of rebound back to the store, it hasn't changed since the initial bottle bill?
Correct.
Wow.
Correct. So all your costs have gone up. Our labor costs have gone up. We've got a $15 minimum wage, which will happen in the next 4 years, to keep those rooms clean and to rent the machines, because now there's all reverse vending machines. That's rental equipment that costs money. So
yeah.
We're underwater in those bottle rooms, and we'd like to find a way to at least break even there. We've been a proponent of a study. We think that the beverage distributors, the manufacturers, the grocery stores, the recyclers, everybody needs to get to the table, even the state government, folks in state government, and put the money on the table and figure out a way to deal it back out so that everybody's kind of getting their fair share and doing their fair share of the work. I mean, we redeemed $650 million bottles a year.
Wow.
At retail. $650 million.
That's a lot.
It is, and there's a lot of work that goes into it.
Yeah.
There aren't a lot of places outside of grocery stores to do that, because if you were going to open up your own mom-and-pop redemption center based on the handling fee that you get to do it, it doesn't support a business model. That's part of what's broken. So I think they need to get the people back to the table and resurrect this thing and say, okay, if we're going to live with the bottle law, let's live with it in a way that everybody's
sure.
doing their share.
Yeah, you have to adjust it at least a couple times in 50 years. A couple of more minutes with a guy who represents maybe the neighborhood grocery store you have there. Not the big chain, not Stop and Shop, not ShopRite, Walbaum's, Big Y, Aldi. We love all the stores, but the Connecticut Food Association primarily representing the smaller grocer, smaller retailer. In the state, Wayne Pesci is with us. Wayne, obviously, the minimum wage going up here in Connecticut, it's going to eventually make its way to $15 rather quickly, about a dollar every 11 months or year or so over the next roughly 4 years. What are your member stores saying about that?
Yeah, so very quickly, I just want to clarify. I do represent the grocery retailers, so that would be Stop and Shop.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
Oh, no, Palmer's and Darien, Mariluzzi's,
yeah.
Grocery.
Yeah.
So basically, if you sell just groceries, mm-hmm. and you're not selling sundries. And,
that's what I meant, yeah. Yeah.
Fans and air conditioners, yeah. And things of that nature.
Oh, no, it's, yeah.
Yeah, so it's anybody who sells groceries.
Yeah.
And we also represent the suppliers of the groceries,
sure.
as well. So I just want to make sure.
Yeah. But I meant that, the mom-and-pop grocers, like, I don't go to a big chain a lot. There's a couple of really good, smaller family stores right down the street from me. Yeah, yeah.
Those are always my favorites.
Yep, yep.
So we represent them as well. So,
sure.
Yeah, the minimum wage. Back to the minimum wage. We, again, you got to understand, if you own a grocery store, 30 to 40% of your help is part-time help. We employ seniors, we employ handicapped, we employ disabled, we employ high school, basically to go out and shuck carts and clean bottle rooms and work at registers. So for us, I had one chain owner, a store, they own four stores up in the Hartford area.
Okay.
When the minimum wage goes to $15 an hour, they'll be paying an additional $880,000 a year.
Wow.
In labor.
Wow.
So think about that for a minute. They'll be paying $880,000 more than they currently pay today. They won't have sold anything more than what they sell today,
mm-hmm.
but their costs will have been mandated up.
And that money, and they got to recoup that money, Wayne, somewhere.
Well, listen, no question about it. So how do you do that? You do that in a variety of ways. When you're a small chain like this chain that I describe up in the Hartford market, you don't have a large supply chain to spread those costs across. Basically, you just hire less people, you cut hours, and you raise prices. I mean, that's what you do. I mean, you survive is what you do. $880,000 is a big number.
It's a lot of money. That's a lot. I don't care how much somebody sells. People say, well, you know, the stores are busy. Yeah, but they're busy, Wayne, because they're selling stuff that they had to buy at wholesale. It's not all pure profit. You know what I mean?
Grocery retailer, depending on your size, works on anywhere between 1.5% to 4% margin.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fast nickel is what it is. It's not anything but that. And you know what? We are in the people business. A lot of our retailers, and you talk about the mom and pop retailers, you know, their connection is that relationship they have with that customer at the register.
Yep.
Right? Everybody wants to go where you know my name, right? So that's important to them. And this idea of not having a face at the register is kind of scary, in fact. There are going to be more losers than winners.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, from my perspective, again, this is one man's opinion.
Sure.
We went 100 miles an hour. I think we could have given a minimum wage increase because there hadn't been one in 2 years. I think it should have been slower and over more time. They started this thing in October. One of the complaints we had was what if I built the budget and now all my budget's out of whack because, you know, I've got to start paying more labor rates.
Well, exactly. As a business owner, you consult with your accountant. You consult with, you know, if it's a larger store, you may have a business manager there watching the money. And Wayne, sure, this was real short. Wayne, we're short on time. Wayne Pesch is president of the Connecticut Food Association. Wayne, it was great getting to know you, having you on, and you have our number. So anytime there's just something burning a hole in you, you want to vent on, give us a call, okay?
Yeah, I look forward to talking to you again, Paul. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Wayne. Appreciate it. Wayne Pesch there, P-E-S-C-E. Don't say it's fish. I know that's an Italian last name. Obesh, they used to say. Wayne Pesch is the president of the Connecticut Food Association.
Just a man, a microphone, and a lot of thoughts. Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli, WICC 600.
Hey, thanks. 5:49. I want to wind up on something today that just, honest to God there, that you know by now, listening to me for May, June, July, August. We're coming up on 3 months here, which is cool. You know that listening to me, there's certain things, especially journalistically, that drive me crazy. And I, again, I do have a degree in journalism here. I'm a credentialed journalism guy. And I do radio news every so often, but I've really segued to talk for the past 20 or 30 years. But I still watch how things are reported. It's fascinating how TV reports things, radio and newspapers. And one thing that that just drives me crazy is when newspapers, radio, television, but primarily newspapers, when they don't have a set of balls. I'm sorry, that's a little frank for you. I can use huevos. I can use castanets. If you're of the Italian extraction, would you prefer guglions? Would you prefer cojones? We'll keep it multi-ethnic here. Well... But I don't know whether you saw and we talked about this the other day with Mario Lopez about what he said, that he thought maybe, you know, if a 3-year-old goes to mommy and daddy and says, you know, if it's a girl, I want to be a boy. If it's a boy, he says, if it's a boy, you know, the kid says, I want to be a girl, mommy and daddy. Mario Lopez was pilloried the other day for saying maybe it's a better idea if parents don't take that as gospel if the kid's 2 or 3 years old. Well, you know, the Twitter sphere, Twitter universe went crazy. I don't know whether you saw this. Let's take this back to the journalism angle now. Did you see what happened with the New York Times yesterday? Did you see this? if you thought that there was a chance that the New York Times, we have a lot of New York Times readers in this area, Fairfield County, a lot of, you're on that train in the morning heading to Manhattan, the New York Times, oh my God. See, where I'm from up in Connecticut, we wrap fish with it. We lined a cat box with it. The Metro North Fairfield County crowd, they actually read the thing.
I'm sorry. No, but this is why we wrap fish in it in New Haven, baby, is what I'm saying. After the dweebs at Yale get done with it. The New York Times, they say they ran a... Oh, God, this is awful. From a journalistic standpoint, the New York Times says we ran a flawed headline the other day. Did you see this? Oh, yeah. The New York Times ran a... They say they ran a flawed headline. Now, what am I talking about? Well, when Donald Trump came out the other day after the shootings, okay, president came out after the shootings, and he tried to strike a conciliatory tone. I guess that would be the, I guess that would be the proper tone. You know, saying that, listen, we've got to come together. The, you know, Trump hate has no place. White supremacy. Well, the New York Times headline was such. It was a 5-word headline. You ready? It was a big, it took up like 2/3 of the front page, the top of the fold, if you saw it, before you cut the paper up to, you know, clean your, you know, line on the underside of the car as you're changing your oil. The headline read, Trump urges unity versus racism. Okay? See that? Very simple. Trump urges unity versus racism. Uh-huh. Again, Trump urges unity versus racism. Okay, and I'm reading that going, well, that's what he tried to do during the speech. Now, people who love him say, oh, that was a great speech. People who hate him say, you know, get out of here, you piece of filth. We know how this is going to play out, right? Well, the headline ran to the Times' first print edition. It was changed in subsequent editions. The Times told USA Today that they said it was, the headline was flawed. Why was it flawed? Because a bunch of leftist heads exploded. Folks, you gotta understand that this is the New York freaking Times. Okay, this is America's newspaper of record. I know people say, no, it's the Washington Post. I personally read the Wall Street Journal. No. The New York Times is the paper of record in this country. And they changed the headline. You know who one of the complainers was? That freaking dimwit from New York, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You know what she tweeted? Folks, here's what she said. Let the front page serve as a reminder of how white supremacy is aided by and often relies upon the cowardice of mainstream institutions. By the way, she didn't write that. I'm sorry. You ever see this woman talk? Come on. She didn't write that. I don't care, Aaron. She did not write that. Stop it. She didn't write that. She couldn't put that many syllables together. Trust me. She did not write that. So the New York Times is getting ripped apart by lefties because they didn't pillory Trump. Now, when I went to journalism school, when I got my J degree, I don't know about you, but the front page was for objective news. You know, Dewey defeats Truman. Men walk on moon. Peace in Europe. War over. Nixon resigns. And the Times put... They thought a proper headline, Trump urges unity versus racism, which is what he was trying to do. And then if you wanted to rip somebody apart, you did it on the editorial pages. You had your lead editorial, and then you had your editorial writer say, listen, I don't care what he urged, he's full of crap. But apparently the left went crazy. So AOC apparently, in between coloring books, She was able to tweet that. Let me tell you, we're going to do traffic and weather together here. Oh, it gets better. The lefty heads were exploding because the New York Times dared to put an objective headline out there. God, it's so much fun when liberals go crazy. Honest to God, it's better than goldfish.
The only place in Fairfield County for live local talk. This is Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli, WICC 600.
And those of you who read the New York Times on a regular basis, are you content to read a newspaper that's got no balls? Oh my God, they apologized for a headline. Their headline was flawed. What am I talking about? The headline after Trump's speech, quote, Trump urges unity versus racism, which is what he did. You may not agree with what he said, but that's what a headline of an objective news story is supposed to be. So AOC went crazy. Who else went crazy here? Bah, 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 bah. Cory Booker, yeah, Spartacus. He said to the New York Times, lives literally depend on you doing better, New York Times. Please do. Oh, my God. Kirsten Gillibrand, she's got, what, 1% support? She said, this is not how I would have framed the story. Beto O'Rourke says it's unbelievable. Oh, my God. My God. So so how did they, wait a minute, they covered their rear. They covered their rear here, and they said, well, this was only for the first print edition, and we're sorry. We're so sorry we upset the Upper West Side of Manhattan. No. On the Upper West, everybody above 59th Street on the West Side's going to hate us. Sweet Jesus. What are we going to do? Oh, my God. You people in the New York Times, God almighty, grow a set, will you please? Ugh. You want to rip the guy up, you rip him off, you do it on the editorial page. My God. Now, I will admit AOC was able to say a lot of syllables there. That's good. She gets a gold star in her coloring book.